This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Comedian Jordan Carlos is not afraid to talk politics, whether he's doing an impression of Barack Obama or talking about Donald Trump's Twitter account.
I like how he like tweets things out and thinks that they're lies. Like, everybody that's 5 years old is now 6 years old. It's a law that I just made up.
There we go. It's a clip of comedian Jordan Carlos at Pace Studios earlier this year. Stand-up comedy is not the only realm where Jordan has jumped into politics. He was also a contributor on the satire news program The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. Politics aside, Jordan also loves New York City and nature. In fact, he's even incorporated his affinity for the natural world in his stand-up comedy. He's on the road right now with what he's calling the Whale Sex Tour. Jordan performs tomorrow at Motor Co. in Durham, but he first joins me on our show. Jordan Carlos, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Let's talk. Really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate having you. I'm going to have to talk about whale sex first,
sure.
And your tour. What is it about whales and sex that draws you, that makes you think that's funny, Jordan?
Well, I think it's a little personal,
okay.
But I'll get into it. I was looking for something that, you know, basically because we live in such divisive times wherein we, you know, check every bumper sticker on the car ahead of us to see where, you know, to check the temperature, so to speak. I felt that what about a joke that brings us all together? And we aren't whales. So
that's a good one. But actually,
yeah,
you've done the research on this, sex. I mean, it's kind of interesting.
Well, it's very important as a comedian to procrastinate.
Mm-hmm.
So much procrastination, and so I happen to procrastinate by watching nature shows. Mm. I love those, and you get to hear, you know, I mean, I love when British people tell me about nature.
yeah,
something about their accents. So, Sir Richard Attenborough, when he speaks, I shut up. I make no other plans,
mm-hmm.
I listen to what he has to say. Let it wash over me like a cool mist. And what he said about humpback whales and how they procreate is, you know, in essence, and not to get too graphic, that there's you need three to tango.
It's a buddy system. They do menage a trois.
Yes. It's the worst. It's the worst because somebody is just there for the pushing. And they get nothing out of it. I mean, maybe they get something. I don't know the whales. They might get something out of that.
Clearly they get some because they've been doing it for a long time. Well, this is very cool. But talk about this, too, because you do a lot of satire, but also you do these other kinds of other forms of comedy and about other subjects.
Absolutely.
What are you finding with audiences these days? What are they laughing at and what do they not want to laugh at?
There's been a lot of psychic laughter, a lot of just like, you know, everybody's very uptight. And they just want to laugh at something. it's a combination of things. They laugh at politics up to a point wherein we realize the morass that we're living in. And then you switch subjects, right? So you switch to whether it's like animals or relationships or anything like that. There is a bit of a need for escapism. So the absurdity can give you escapism, right? And funny stories that have nothing to do with the headlines. So it's about finding that kind of balance between headlines and then also, you know, the funny pages, basically. That's why they're in there. That's why the cartoons are in there, right? That's why we...
Well, but they have their own page. Yeah. And I'm wondering what you do on stage now, because it raises an interesting point. I mean, satire, when, you know, there was sort of a kind of normal and a range of normal in which, right, to operate. And then you could go outside that and be funny. And now it's like, where do you go? Do you find yourself interspersing it? So you break it up a couple of political jokes, and then let's get back to the whales, or how's it going?
I start out talking about New York a little bit, and just that New York hasn't changed much, and that, you know, I still have very few normal human interactions there, and that, you know, so I talk about that, about how I was walking out of therapy one day, and this woman came up to me and she goes, "Hey, aren't you somebody?" And then I walked right back into my therapist's office because. It's not safe out there. Do you understand? I talk about that. Then I get into the world that we live in, right? So I'm like, it's crazy out there. And jokes about our reaction to how crazy things are, I think, That's the commonality. You know, that's what we all have in common. It doesn't matter what your, you know, political affiliation is, because I did Politicon and in California about a month ago, and that was fun. And, you know, at Politicon, there were all kinds of people there. But what I did find was what made people laugh was that we are all trying to negotiate very fraught times. Right. You know, that's that, and people love laughing at the fact that, you know, I used to make I made George Bush jokes, and now people are a little kinder to him. Yeah. Some people are like, but yeah, he's a good painter, you know. So there's been a lot of that, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's I think that's what's really intrigued me is that that is what people respond to. They respond to that. They respond to, like, last night we were talking about Kim Jong-un and, you know, him kind of backing down and what that means. You know, like we are living in crazy times, right, when Kim Jong-un is like, I'm going to just let this play itself out.
These people are nuts. I got to go over here and just stay where I am.
It's crazy.
Great. It's comforting, I guess, to know that we do still recognize this as crazy, because you'd hate to adjust to this. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No. I don't want this to be normalized. Mm. But, you know, when you address that we are living in these kind of like panicked times, people see that, you know, they you're feeling it. I'm feeling it. It's not normal at all. Great. You know. So that's been the binding agent, really. For the show, and it's gone really well. I mean, sometimes I'll prattle on, and you're only supposed to do 45 minutes in a lot of these shows. And last night I did like I was in Birmingham and I did like an hour and a half. Wow. So because people want to hear it, you know, and I love the sound of my own voice.
Well, but raises an issue. You talk about Birmingham, yeah, Alabama. You travel the country. Are there, mm-hmm, places? Are there regions in the country where different jokes play differently?
Sure. Some places have civic pride. I'd say Birmingham has civic pride. I was in Indiana where there wasn't much of it. And, you know, Indianapolis is a beautiful city. And I said, this is a beautiful city you've built, and no one showed up, you know. And everybody really liked that, yeah, you know. So from town to town, things matter. But there's different tastes. But what I've found is that everybody's looking at bumper stickers of the cars ahead of them, right? Mm. We all, a large part of the South and the Middle West is, you know, that's car culture. So people could understand that. And I said, you know, like one day aliens will come down and look at our artifacts and be like, you know, they wore their feelings on the butt of the car. We're not sure why, but it meant so much, yeah, you know? I'd say, not to repeat myself, but the commonality is that we're all going through it together.
I wish they were looking at bumper stickers. They used to. Now they're looking at their phones, and that kind of scares me. But I guess that's true. I'm happy to know that somewhere where you're driving, they're looking actually at the car in front of them and not into the mirror as they gaze into their cell phone.
That's true. I do that.
Yeah. Let me ask you about, you worked on the Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. Mm-hmm. Tell us,
yes,
about how did you get involved with that show?
Oh, I hustled my way onto that. That was, that was pure New York hustle. Mm-hmm. So I tracked down Rory Albanese, who's the executive producer for the show. And Rory was giving a panel discussion about the environment with Norman Lear. And so I stalked him. I stalked Rory. And it was like at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday, and it was just a couple of retirees and me.
Yeah.
That was there.
But look, you got to be more than just a pain in the neck, right? I mean, there must have been something about what you were doing that fit what they were doing, right? What do you think?
I asked three cogent questions. I can't remember what they were.
Yeah.
I asked three cogent questions. I saw Rory after. I asked him, you know, I knew that they were developing the show and asking if they needed writers. Rory said, come to my office tomorrow. So I did. I couldn't believe it. It worked. You know, So I go over to his office, and Rory is so funny, but also loves to talk. He's a New Yorker that loves to talk. And I said hello, and then he talked for an hour. So then I was like, oh, my gosh, I think I'm going to get this job. And then he says, you know, you're really great. You know, so I had said nothing. So he goes, why don't you – let's – you guys – you got to meet Larry. I was like, okay, I got to meet Larry. This is – I'm passing to level two. I go to level two and they do the exact same thing. I say hello. Larry and Rory talk for an hour, you know, like just joking back and forth. I'm laughing, you know, and I'm like, this is – how can I not get this job, right? Larry – of course, very smart guy. At the end, I was like, "Well, start on Monday, right, fellas? You know, like let's get the office together." He goes, "How about a writing packet?" And I was like, "Oh, that thing, right? yes."
Got one.
So no, I didn't. No. I didn't. I had hustled my way that far. I'd blustered my way that far. So I said, I panicked, and I go, "Why don't you just come to a comedy show of mine?" So, because I tried writing packets before, nothing had really clicked. So they come to a comedy show of mine. They love it, and then they're like, "Well, we're going to do a Comedy Central showcase." So it's 30 comedians, and I was the only one who got laughs. I'm the hero of the story.
Wow!
But the point is, that's how I got the job.
Was it different? Yeah. Different. Well, and what about writing for yourself and writing for someone else in a show like that? I mean, is there, you have to go into a whole different mode? Is that what happens to you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you have to give away some of your best stuff. And I was happy that, you know, one of the colonels, and I, you know, some of it you're so proud of that you can, you know, write for somebody else. That's what it's about, finding their voice. You know, Larry calls himself a passionate centrist, and I, you know, and I had to find out what that was exactly. So I had to, like, shut down a part of my brain, just listen to what Larry's POV and give him the tools he needed necessary to go out there every night. You know, and one of them I was really proud of, it ended up in the Ana DuVernay documentary, 13th. It was a segment about Dylann Roof, right? And which was such a tough thing to tackle, right. Especially, you know, because, you know, comedy shows just aren't built for the, who knows if comedy shows are built for these
times?
Yeah,
but not that. That's a rough one. Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah, that's a rough one. So I said, you know, I had this kind of pitch about, like, the emotional roller coaster that we go on. You get on the roller coaster, you know, and the first part, at least for African Americans, in a mass shooting is, was it one of us, right? Mm-hmm. So you hold your breath, you cross your fingers. Turns out it isn't. Now, this got, like, a big laugh on the show, and I could not believe, you know, I mean, I was like, will people follow me on this? Will Larry follow me on this? He trusted me. It went well. And now there's a, you know, it lives on in this documentary. Mm-hmm. And that was the, you know, I mean, listen, I usually make poop jokes. So this was the maximum expression of my, you know, of what I could do.
Well, and Larry got to say that because it's one of us, right? And so the pronoun there is us. He's not on the air anymore. What's the void? What do you think is the space left open in the world? There's plenty of satire out there, but Larry Wilmore.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, there's a lot in the pipe right now, though. I know that you know, Jordan Klepper's working on a show. Even people from our own show, The Nightly Show, are getting shows. Robin Thede is getting a show, and then Francesca Ramsey. So, you know, these are all piloted things. And I was just writing and producing a pilot for TBS for Baratunde Thurston that would possibly come on after Samantha Bee. Also, Grace Parra is also piloting a show as well. So I feel like there's definitely, I mean, maybe the fact that Larry went out there and did his thing, you know, and, you know, that germinated other comedians to find their voice and say, yeah, I mean, there's a space on late night on the landscape for different voices, you know.
Now, Stephen Colbert, famously white. But you, yeah, even more famously, his black friend Alan on that show,
yes,
who didn't have much to say. But on this particular episode, you actually had a line. Let's listen.
Alan, bring out Dr. King's FBI file. Okay? This is Alan. He works here. By the way, the network is making Alan work on Martin Luther King Day as well. Right? And listen. Alan, I'm just as angry about this as you are.
I'm not angry.
Stay strong.
Yeah, that's a clip of the Colbert Report with comedian Jordan Carlos. Jordan performs tomorrow at Motorco in Durham. Tell us about that character and what you developed for that, and maybe what you took away from that show, having developed that character.
My career has just been a series of kind of like lucky incidents, and I have a buddy, Frank Lesser, who is a writer for the show, and I was doing nothing at the time, hanging out in my apartment, playing a lot of Xbox, and Frank. Frank was like, Jordan, I pitched an idea where you'd be a black friend to Steven, you know? And I was like, first I was like, Steven who? Who are we talking about, you know? Then, because I hadn't really watched the show. And then I watch it. First, I don't get it. I was like, Frank, who are you working for? This is, we need to talk, you know? And then it washes over me that it's satire. Mm. So, because it's on Comedy Central. But, I went in and, you know.
So you had to tell yourself, oh, no, it's comedy? Is that what you're saying?
I had to tell myself after I got out of my haze. So I make my way. He's like, can you come over to the studio? And I was like, I'm not doing particularly much right now. So, yeah. So I went over. I met Steven. Then I took a very, very what has become a famous photograph with him where he points to me. And then he has his arm around me. Someone was asking me something, and I had this kind of, I don't know, like not all too happy look on my face. And then the photo was taken, and then they used that photo on the show. The photo has been memed so many times as the black friend photo. I feel like the Armagosh girl because of it. It lives out there and has a life of its own. Yeah. And after that, it was off to the running. So I did about 4 or 5 episodes after, and, you know, I got agents and managers after. Working with Steven was very cool. I never got to talk to him, I think, out of character, which was kind of crazy. Yeah. So it would be like I'd be brought in, and then – but it was amazing, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you had this fantastic, absurdist character just, like, you know, traipsing around the set. – And I'd be like, hey, you know, like any chance I could get a job around it, you know, but it was terrific. It was a very good idea. And I think one of his first that kind of like really hit home on the dynamics of like, of race, you know. Yeah. It was great. Yeah.
Well, we talked at the top of the show about your love of nature, and I want to get back to that because you recently hosted Shark Week on Snapchat for Discovery.
Oh my gosh!
Tell us about that. That's
it just brought it all home. You keep talking about animals, yeah, they'll find you. They will find you.
Yeah.
So on Snapchat, yeah, I did Shark Week and had a great time talking about megalodons and hammerheads, who are the latest to show up on our planet. Because I love sharks because they're absolute survivors, and there's something about that I love. I've told you like one story after another about hustling, and I love that about sharks. So hopefully if I ever do come across any, that they won't gobble me up. But we talked about provoked and unprovoked shark attacks, and those provoked ones don't get much play. And afterward, I got stopped in the street by the young ones. They were I was the shark guy, you know.
Duh. So the Snapchatters knew you. The Snapchatters knew exactly who you were.
They knew exactly who I was.
They knew he was comedian Jordan Carlos, who's going to perform tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at Motorco in Durham as part of his whale sex tour. Jordan, what a pleasure. Great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
You can find out more about Jordan and his tour at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of the Rusty Wright Band. Till it just ain't funny. Put down and pushed around and lost all my money. I play by your rules, but you won't let me through. Get P.O.'d and angry, I'm just asking you. Ain't that the blues?